Welcome Underground. In this episode, we welcome our first guest. Artem is a philosopher of corporate ethics, an economist, and a longtime friend of the show. He's helping us get to the bottom of what money is, looking for a description that can even explain the US trade deficit and the use of Maria Teresa Thaler's in Red Sea trade, while remaining simple enough for the two of us to understand. Enjoy.
I'm an economist by training who currently works as a risk manager. But I came around to kind of talk with a historian, I guess an accountant.
Yeah, right.
about money. That's one of the topics that interests me. Money is an institution that obviously structures our society, our daily life in a significant way, structures even the way we think, we make decisions, we rationalize what we do and why, how we estimate what's a good thing to do, what's a less reasonable thing to do. And at the same time, it's an institution that's more or less entirely taken for granted. We seem to have a good practical understanding of money, of how to use it, but we don't really talk about it. It's not really thematized. People don't really have a good picture of, just what is it? Where does it come from? How does it even exist? How is this monetary structure reproduced in society? How can we rely on it? Are there any unobvious consequences of the way money exists and is structured in our society? Is there a way to do it differently? Should we be doing it differently? So that's a kind of a range of things we wanted to touch on, but also just talk about money as a curiosity, because there are a lot of interesting vignettes around money that we can talk about as well.
Yeah, I saw a meme the other day that was of a man looking sad next to a train, and the meme caption was, when I was young, I thought about music and art. Now I'm in my 30s, all I think about is money, and that really resonated with me. So there we go. That's maybe is the the lived reality that we all go through, is actually that it occupies a hell of a lot of our thoughts.
At the same time, we assume it is just a constant, a given. Mm. This bit of paper is worth this much of my time. Okay.
We see that instantiated in the world, don't we? We use money every day, and we see the tangible effects of having it and the tangible effects of not having it. And so it presents itself to us as a sort of a law of nature, as just a feature of our reality that that operates. And so we have to fit ourselves around it. As you were saying, actually thinking about it in the abstract and assessing what it is and thinking about it in that way is not something that we need to do day to day in order to use it, and so we don't.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of in the nature of money, is what's often called a universal medium, right? And the universal medium is an interesting thing, because on one hand, it structures everything you do, right? But to do anything in society, whether you want to watch a movie, buy some food, whatever, get some services, whatever you want to do, you need to do it via money. You work for money to be able to do something else. So in one way, all your life is structured around money. You literally can't do almost anything except via money. But at the same time, precisely because it's a universal medium, it's kind of invisible, right? It exists to make things smooth. So it intermediates everything, but it puts itself as much in the background as possible, right? It wants to make itself not seen, to make the transaction go smoothly. Make it seem as if you go smoothly from, working in an office to watching a movie. But at the same time, it wouldn't be possible except through this medium. And that in itself is quite an interesting thing.
Yeah. I think as a historian, the way that I would start to talk about money would be through, talking about how it emerges from the need for humans to cooperate with each other. That would be my sort of starting point. And I would, take you through the sort of, the way maybe the Romans developed money, or the first coinage, what its features were, and, the feature, what the function it needs to fulfill, paying soldiers, et cetera, and paying people for goods and services, and the features of the technology that's needed in order to achieve that, and blah 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 blah. But I understand you kind of have a thesis you'd like to talk about particularly, which is a particular view of money in the modern world. And I'm just interested in how you'd like to kind of go about. Would you be interested in sort of us sketching out a theory from our perspective of what money is and how it develops, or would you like to sort of launch into your
I think we can do it in a couple of ways. So I wanted to pick up on your comment because, as you said, how would you introduce money as a historian? That in itself is a very interesting question. If we pose the question, just what is money? Well, how do we even go about answering that kind of question. What do we do? One way we could try to trace the history, right? Mm. The facts.
Yeah,
of
that's what, always my instinct, yeah.
It's always mine as well, yeah.
But of course, you kind of have to have a ready-made answer of what do you identify as money, right? Which facts are you looking for in history to understand, yes, this is a use of money and this isn't?
Yeah, and when you're looking at history, you're often fixated on the token itself, the object. So you trace the, sort of the development of coins over the centuries, but that's probably missing the wider point.
It could well be, right? You can fixate on the physical token. That's a very natural thing to do. You know, we're physical creatures. But you can have a monetary system. Well, actually, we have a monetary system right now, which is almost not tokenized, right? You can have a monetary system which is entirely based on records. No tokens change hands.
Numbers on a screen.
Yeah. Mm. And actually, that system is much older than it seems. If you go back to Babylonian times, it was hugely a records-based system, not a token-based system.
Basically all of those clay tablets that we dig up that have been baked hard are just records of, you know, I owe this bureaucrat three sheep and three
gallons
of wine.
Okay, I always thought that was kind of working, like what I do in Excel. But no, that was actually the database.
That was the database, and money was not really tokenized, and you only had physical transfers when you had to do long trade external transactions. So between us in our community, when a transaction happens, we just make a record because, you know, why even exchange a token? It's a practical difficulty that you don't even need to come face to face with. But if you want to trade with somebody you don't know, somebody far away, then you better actually deliver something of value, and that's when you would deliver silver.
Yeah.
So the very question of how do we even go about answering questions like what is money? The other way you can do it is, of course, you can think about the function, and that's a very different way of thinking, right? You are abstracting from history. You're just thinking, okay, well, people in the abstract, agents, when they cooperate, they face typical problems wherever they are in history. There might be a technology, again, in the abstract, which allows them to solve these problems. And that technology can take very different physical form. It can take a form of a record, of a token, of maybe even something else. So you can think about money that way. And there are yet other ways of thinking about money. So even the question of how do we answer the question of what is money is not that easy to answer. And they're a very interesting one because it goes back to, you know, just thinking how do we answer questions about key features of our society generally. But I thought a nice way to introduce some of the problematic would be to paint a couple of vignettes around unusual ways money is used or it affects our society. And I thought the first one, which is kind of very topical, we can talk about the United States and its trade deficit. You know, that's very actively thematized in contemporary politics. The current president seems to think that the deficit is a problem. But it's an interesting fact. So, you know, what is a trade deficit really? It means that America is able to buy goods and it does not provide goods or services in return. All it provides in return are dollars. So the world supplies America with valuable products, and all it gets in return is dollars, and that's the deficit. How can that even happen, and how can that happen for so long in such a wide scale? Well, money is just a nice thing to have, right? Why do you even engage in production? Why do they make jeans in Thailand? Well, they're making it for money, right? Because why else? That the point of production is for sale. You want money. Sometimes you want money to spend, but you also want money just to have, right? It's nice to have a dollar balance. So, you know, and we have several billion people in the world, each of which would like to have a dollar balance, which they don't really have. But that puts America in a very interesting place, because if the entire world just wants to have a dollar balance, not to spend, but just to have, that means you can just buy things by issuing dollars, which fill these balances. People want to keep them, they're not going to spend them. Having them as a saving is value enough. So America can just get goods for free, as long as there is an unfulfilled need for a balance. And, you know, do you guys have a balance that you're comfortable with, or would you be happy to fill it up a little bit?
Yeah, no, a bit more would be nice.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be averse to.
So the entire world, and we are, by world standards, incredibly well off, right? So you can imagine how much of a reservoir there is for dollar demand and how much more America can get from the world in terms of goods and services without having to give anything in return except for paper, well, not even paper, a record.
Numbers on
the
screen.
Numbers on the screen that it can issue at will.
But I'm sure you're going to explain this now very eloquently, but of course my immediate thought upon that would be, say, well, it's not, the dollar is merely a cipher for something. You know, the dollar is a proxy for goods and services in the future. So it's a token, or it's a sign or a symbol that you hold in the present, which gives you the power to obtain things or potentially obtain things in the future, and that gives you security and, you know, all of those other psychological well-being factors. And so it's not really about the token, it's about what it signifies, what it's the proxy for. But I'm, you know, that would be my immediate response to that way of looking at it.
And I think that's exactly right. But you've hit on a critical point there, that it's the power, the potential, not the actual expenditure. And that's why I started that people want to have dollars not just to spend, but for the ability to spend. Yeah. And right, you can imagine that most of us are probably going to go into our grave with some kind of a balance, right? Because we want to leave a balance to our children. But even if we don't, I don't think many people are in a mind where, well, I'm going to spend everything down to zero just as I die.
I think some boomers are minded that way a bit, but perfection is dying with a...
If we all knew the date of our deaths, would we act differently?
My last check will bounce.
That's an interesting question. You know, you could see that as a function of uncertainty. But yes, I take your point. Yeah.
Because the potential is itself valuable.
Yes.
And potential only exists as long as it's unrealized, if you see what I mean.
Yep.
Once you spend the money, you no longer have it. So actually, the entire world wants to have unspent money, and that gives America this incredible, Barry Eichengreen called it the exorbitant privilege. There's an excellent book on it, of being the kind of the major money issue. And that's just a nice vignette to show how much value you can extract from being the issue of a currency that is widely accepted. Second vignette, in a similar spirit, but a little bit different, is the story of the Maria Theresa Thaler. Do any of you know what it is? You might have come across it. You should have come across it.
Ooh, was that the Austro-Hungarian
currency?
Yeah.
So that's an incredible story. Have you seen any of them? Because they're still in circulation.
No, I once found a small hoard of Thalers. They weren't Maria Theresa, but it was of silver coins from across Europe. From about the 15th, 16th century.
That's a great story. The Maria Theresa Thaler, issued in the name of the Empress Maria Theresa of Austria-Hungary in the 18th century, was one of major silver coins of the European market. Was the currency of Austria-Hungary for a while, but incredibly it became the dominant currency in the region which stretched from the coasts of the Red Sea up to the Persian Gulf, Oman, Muscat, and down to Ethiopia.
So in other words, a quite different region from the region in which it is issued and intended for.
And so the original impulse for that seems to be, and we don't really understand the story of it, the original impulse seems to be the coffee imports. So a lot of coffee was imported from that region via the port of Trieste.
That's where it's all from, yeah.
Yeah, the Austro-Hungarian port, and of course, you know, Vienna is famous for its coffee consumption. And that seems to have been paid with a good quality silver currency. And it seems the original impetus was simply that the Thalers, the Austrian-Hungarian monetary policy was very stable.
You can trust that it's silver content.
The silver content in the Thaler was very good. The way it was minted in a quite a fine way that was hard to counterfeit. So people could easily confirm authenticity by like counting the number of pearls on the necklace of Maria Theresa and other little things like that. But the incredible thing with it was, so the issuance started in the 18th century, and then in the 19th century, Europe moved to a gold standard, and so did Austria-Hungary. Silver was demonetized in Austria-Hungary. That coin ceased circulation in Europe. But it continued circulation in this region. I mean, I'm going to call it the Red Sea region. It's wider than that, but just for ease of use. It's a bunch of countries on both sides and up to the Persian Gulf. That continued to be highly used there for both internally and externally, so for Westerners coming in and completing purchases, but also for an internal trade circuit that kind of went from the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea to the Horn of Africa and back to the Persian Gulf. That continued even when silver got demonetized. So it stopped being legal tender anywhere, but it continued to be practical tender in that region. Now, a lot of these holdings were Ottoman. So the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century very consciously tried to eradicate the Maria Theresa thaler, replace it with its own sovereign currency. It failed. Austria kind of lost interest in the issuance of that currency at some point. So it sold rights to the minting of that currency to several mints. It sold them to French. It sold them to British. The British minted it in Bombay, in India. And, you know, Austria had to sell the physical dies just because the counterfeiting was so hard. And the issuance of the Austria-Hungarian thaler for the needs of the Red Sea region continued from France and Britain, and even the Indian holdings in Britain. It continued into the 20th century. Mussolini bought the rights for the issuance of the thaler in the 20th century. And that was a lot of counterfeiting from European powers as well. And several other powers tried to displace the use of the thaler in the region because, Austro-Hungarians never had any interest in the regions. They never held these regions. And other sovereign states tried to replace them. They all failed. Haile Selassie of Ethiopia tried to introduce sovereign currency, failed. Mussolini, after he took over Ethiopia, tried to introduce his own currency, failed. And that kind of makes no sense because even if you just trust the silver content, the silver content, you can just trade bars of silver. Or moreover, the currency was so valuable that it continued to be profitable for England, France, Italy to buy the rights to issue it. So the value of the coin was far in excess of its silver content, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was worth it to mint it, to ship it, mm-hmm. And continue doing so for centuries after it even ceased being legal tender. So that's an interesting question of, just how is that possible?
Well, I think that's the element of money that I possibly find the most interesting, which is the faith element. And I choose that word very specifically because I think that we often miss out when we're talking about what I would characterize, not necessarily pejoratively, as dry sort of mathematical or economical matters, we miss the absolutely crucial enabling ingredient for all of this to work, which is the human mind. And the human mind works through the investiture of meaning into certain things, and it also works through through faith, through trusting in some things. And the way that it tends to articulate that is actually through what we would think of as religious-style belief. And I think that that's associated with symbols, it's associated with what might be called archetypes, and I think how those interact with money is one of the ways of really getting under the skin of what money is. I don't think it's a coincidence that sort of shiny metals tend to be used for money. I don't think it's a coincidence that we put images on coinage that are often invested with sort of sacral significance. And I don't think that it's a coincidence that in our more secular or post-religious age that money has become more abstracted and less invested with those features either. So I think that there's something quite interesting, but also quite nebulous. It's difficult to pin that down, but I think that's something that is definitely worth thinking about as well. And I think that is what can explain a phenomenon like the one that you've just described with the tailor. It's not to do with the physical properties of the coin. It's to do with a cultural attitude towards it, which we can think of as sort of faith. It's more like an icon. It's an object that's invested with more than its physical form would suggest.
Yeah, I think there are definitely elements of that going on. And so in that region, actually, it has become a real cultural centerpiece. It's used as an element of jewelry. You can find necklaces and other objects where the thaler is integrated as a decorative element.
I guess given gifts of silver at weddings and things like that would be pretty standard, and so this is a good way of doing it. Yeah.
And a lot of the symbolism is really quite paradoxical in that story. So, I mentioned that at some point a lot of the issuance moved to France. So in the Arabian Peninsula, that coin wasn't even known as the Maria Theresa Thaler. The standard name for it locally was the Real Al Franci. It was known as the French Real. And actually, currently in the Gulf, you have the real currencies that date from that currency. The original real was the Maria Theresa Thaler. One of the historical ways of trying to kind of understand money, and that's quite a common story, it does actually have to do with divine offerings. Coins or standardized sacred objects came around as a way of giving sacrifice and giving offerings to the gods in some kind of universally accepted way. What is it that you give? Well, you have this specific symbolic element crafted from something precious and rare and something that befits the whole sacral setting. And that's kind of one of the stories of how money came about.
Oh, wait, so you sort of, you cash in your goats or blankets for some token, and then
which
that's
you bring
what
to
you,
the temple.
Rather than having to take your goats to the temple and sacrifice them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not least because the temple functionaries don't really have anything to do with the goats, right? Where would they put them?
It's also interesting that actually when you're thinking about something really important, like a sacrifice to a god, you need to make sure that it's valid. And actually, the thing about gold or these elements, sort of elemental currencies like gold or silver, is that an ounce of gold and another ounce of gold are identical as far as the human faculties can tell, whereas one cow and another cow are not identical. You know, no matter how carefully you choose them, they're not going to be identical. And that's problematic when you come to, you know, human activities about controlling the unknown, because you want to make sure that your offering is worthwhile and valid, and that's difficult.
You're controlling the controllables. Yeah.
Yes, you can't control whether your cow is as pure and as perfect as you like, but if you can turn that cow into something that only has one quality because it's an element, then suddenly that's much better, and you feel much better about it, because an ounce of gold is just an ounce of gold. It doesn't have the imperfections of biology or anything like that.
Of course, let's be a little bit careful here. Gold was not seen as an element at that point.
You're right. You're right. It's anachronistic, but it explains why one ounce of gold is much like another ounce of gold is functionally
identical. And there's another great vignette here, which is absolutely in plain sight, but people don't think about it. But everybody knows this. Everybody knows the story of Jesus and the money changers.
I was just thinking of that.
Why are there money changers in the temple?
Yeah.
And that's exactly why we talked about. People brought money and they exchanged it in the temple to obtain the right shekels in which they could make the sacrifice.
Oh, so you're converting your provincial currencies into shekels so you can make the sacrifice.
Exactly. Nobody really thinks about that. Yeah. There are money changers in the temple. And we understand that it doesn't quite fit, so it kind of makes sense that Jesus expelled them.
Yeah, but the street market going to the temple.
Why were they in the first place? Yeah. They were actually serving a religious purpose. Mm.
A generous commission.
So I think if we talk about money, we have to address the kind of, you could say, the party line, the standard theory of why money exists, and that's kind of the barter theory of money that everyone will be familiar with. So I don't think we need to dwell on it too long, but you know, the story is individuals need to engage in exchange. Engaging in exchange of actual goods and services is quite hard. You need this thing called the double coincidence of wants, which is I must have what you need, you must have what I need. Much better to have some kind of standard good for which there is a standard demand, which can be used as a medium, right? And the idea is that this kind of medium can arise naturally just through the requirements of exchange, and A specific good will take place of this intermediating good. And it makes sense that this kind of good doesn't spoil, that it has a high value per volume and per weight. And so a precious metal seems like a natural candidate for this kind of thing.
If I can interject there, I mean, one classic example of this is, you know, we have the word salary, and that comes from sal, which is Latin for salt. And in the early days, Roman legionaries were paid with salt. And the reason why salt is a suitable currency is because it's portable, it's easily divisible. It's very, very difficult in an ancient context to get more of it, which means that it's got the quality of hardness, and that's the technical term of that it's difficult to dilute the value of it by producing more of it. And so it's those qualities that make it a suitable vector for, or a suitable medium for the transmission of value. It's the portability, divisibility, and hardness, which is, you know, features that the precious metals also share. Yeah,
exactly. And so that's kind of the standard theory, and I think most people have an awareness of something like that theory. So if somebody's pushed to ask what is money, they would say that, well, you have this barter story, a particular good that has the right qualities to be the intermediating good, and then paper money kind of comes about as a derivation of that, in a way, like a certificate for this kind of good, or it stands in for it.
I was going to start this episode with telling that story and then waiting for you to tear it apart.
Again, if you read the literature on money, tearing apart of the barter exchange story is so standard by now that people don't even bother doing it. But, you know, we've already kind of done it. We've already talked about lots of things that have to do with money that make it clear that there is more to the story than that, right? The story of salt cannot explain the Maria Theresa Thaler. It cannot really explain the U.S. trade deficit. We need something more here. The problems with the barter story, normally it's lambasted on what I think is a weak point, is that it's completely ahistorical, right? If we look at how money emerged, if we look historically at what became money, we never see the story we just told, that we started with barter and there was already an economy, and then within barter a particular good emerged. When people want to substantiate the barter story with some kind of empirical evidence, you will often hear, well, in prison they use cigarettes as a means of exchange, or in Germany when there was hyperinflation they used soap as that kind of thing. And of course, that's true, that existed, but what should strike us about these examples is just how abnormal they are, right? We see that this kind of role for currency only arises in very dysfunctional context where the normal monetary system precisely has broken down and people had to resort to create some kind of currency substitute based on the means.
Weird and also recent, I think, which is
And historically, we don't see that at all. In many ways, money kind of precedes the kind of active economic activity that you need for the needs of barter to arise in the first place, for a good to then emerge to fulfill those needs.
Yes, I was just about to say, I think that actually a better way of seeing that is that the people who were engaged in those activities using cigarettes or using soap in those contexts, they are people who already know what money is and they are then deprived of it and have to try and replicate it.
You're so using soap as money, right?
Exactly, yeah. So you're putting the kind of, by thinking that that's evidence for the development of money, you're putting the cart before the horse.
That's exactly right, and that's kind of a valid criticism, but I think it sort of misses the point, because I think the barter story is still very useful because it does point to a genuine function that money fulfills. Like, it might have never arisen in that way, but it still tells us something interesting about money. It doesn't tell us everything interesting, so we can't really stop at it. We have to look at various other ways to explain what's going on. And one of the interesting ways, so this is kind of, you referred to a thesis, not really my thesis, but something interesting to talk about, is the so-called credit theory of money. And this comes down similarly to the barter story for a particular need that arises in any kind of cooperation, but a very different kind of need than the difficulties of barter and the need to kind of resolve this double coincidence of wants problem. The need that credit addresses is the need of intertemporal planning, or knowing that you will produce in the future and being able to trade for it in the present. I kind of am currently coming up. The good thing about the barter story is that you can really tell a nice kind of pseudo-historical vignette and people understand it. It's what one may call a state of nature account of money, right? We can imagine the state of nature where there's only barter, and we can see how out of the state of nature it makes sense for something like money to emerge. These stories are very powerful because they're easily comprehensible.
Aquatic ape theory.
I'm kind of trying to come up with a state of nature account for the credit theory of money, and I think we can kind of do it. We can imagine a society, firstly, we need to kind of abstract from the kind of needs that barter creates. So the barter story relies on there being many goods and people needing to engage in spot trading. So let us imagine something very distinct. An economy where only one good is produced. So there is no talk of exchange of goods at all. It seems in such an economy, money cannot arise. Yeah, at least not on the barter story, right? Mm-hmm. On the barter story, whatever good is produced is itself money in any way that money would need to exist. But we can actually see that there are problems even in the one good economy.
Perhaps if we could, you know, visualize this as my grain or something to make it tangible. So yeah, the one good is grain.
Yeah, so the state of nature, I imagine, actually, is a fishing village.
Okay.
We can look at it not just as one, but maybe an archipelago, but the idea being that people in this economy, what they do is fish. That's all they have. So every day they put out boats to sea, they bring some fish in, and they eat it. And, you know, that's the economy.
Alexander the Great is supposed to have come across people like this in Gedrosia. He called them the fish eaters. Apparently they absolutely stink. So there you go.
I think this kind of scenario is not unrealistic, right? Of course, people never restrict their activities to just fishing, but for sure there are many societies out there for whom fishing is the primary and the most significant economic activity.
Fiji and,
Oh, especially in Australasia.
Yeah.
So in this economy, we can imagine that we have to make a decision here. Where money really couldn't arise, the way I see it, is if that economy was incredibly poor, and that I mean in a very technical sense, where people had to work 100% of their available time just to feed themselves.
Right.
That would be a very simple economy, completely devoted to basically sustenance, right? Yep. Where every day you have to fight for your life, you have to go out, fish, you feed yourself, next day you have to do the same thing. Now, fortunately, most people don't really live in circumstances like this. Normally, if you go out, you spend several hours of fishing, you can probably feed yourself and you can feed some other people. And that raises a problem. So, you know, let's say we have a village of 100 people, 100 households, whatever. We know that if all 100 went out and fished, they would produce way more fish than they need for that particular day. Let's assume for simplicity that fish spoils, which it really does.
Yeah, I can confirm,
you can't really carry it from day to day. You have to eat what is fished out on a particular day. 100 people don't need to go out and fish. Let's say the productivity is such, you know, we can set it in an arbitrary number, but let's say like 30% need to go out and fish. Which 30? How do you resolve this question? One way to resolve it, well, there are several ways to resolve it. Two non-monetary ways to resolve it are command. You know, there is somebody in charge who says, okay.
You guys
are doing the fishing and I'm doing the eating. Quite a common way to resolve this dilemma. There is also what I call a community solution. We all get together, we decide what's fair. Maybe we say, you know, we do a rotation basis. So, you know, we split, well, let's say it's 33% rather than 3. We split, you guys are blue, you guys are red, you guys are green. And, you know, on Mondays, it's the green people that fish. And on Tuesdays, it's the red people. And so it rotates and we share the proceeds. So command and community are two ways of resolving this problem of surplus production. And they don't involve money. But they involve pretty tricky institutional structures, right? A lot needs to happen for these solutions to be possible. Yeah. You need to have a ruling elite, or you need to have a really intricate and kind of trusted, close-knit community.
That everyone buys into.
Yeah, that everyone buys into, that has legitimacy.
And these work, you know, ceteris paribus, you know, but if one day there's a epidemic, or, you know, one day there's some injuries, or one day the weather's bad, you know, suddenly you can very quickly see how this is going to come under strain.
Yeah.
Because it only works with if conditions are stable.
Yeah. So we can kind of expand our state of nature a little bit, and that's why I'm talking about an archipelago. We can imagine in our archipelago, fishermen can just switch villages. That kind of makes command a no-go, right? Mm. If there is a village chief that tells you, hey, you fish, I eat, well, I just go to a different village. Yeah. Community also only works at a small scale. So like, okay, maybe within one village they can do the community solution where they share in the proceeds, but if we in our village fish out more than we need today, and the other village, let's say, is hit by a hurricane, we don't have a community between us, but we still have this problem of how can we perhaps use our fish fished out today, ship it to them in return for maybe them working tomorrow, right? So there is the surplus distribution problem at an archipelago level now. And we can imagine that at an archipelago level, the community solution is not available, the command solution is not available. What solution do we have? So my theory is that money arises as precisely as this kind of solution for intertemporal production in cases where command and community are not possible for whatever reason. It's intertemporal production because we can solve this problem by I can give you fish today in return for the promise of you giving me fish tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. Really, when we talk about surplus, that's exactly the thing, right? So 30% of the people work today because another 30% can perhaps work tomorrow. And we can make this allocation without even having a community production in place. Mm. How can we make it? Well, I just sell you the fish. You get the fish, I get from you something that I can use in the future to get fish myself. Mm. And this way, in the future, I will be the one that enjoys consumption at leisure, whereas somebody else, perhaps the person who got the fish from me in the first instance, will be doing the work to repay the debt that they incurred. So you can already see how something like money, or at least credit, can certainly arise in this kind of situation, even if we have just one good.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, I believe there's some debate as to if you look at international trade, or that's the wrong word, like 2,000 years ago, you see these ships full of goods moving between, you know, Egypt and Greece or whatever, full of bottles or amphorae, full of whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's some debate over whether that is trade, you know, barter or money being exchanged for stuff, or whether that's actually just gift exchange, in that communities will gift each other things. And there's a sort of honor system or an expectation that they'll probably receive gifts in return at some point. But like you're not recording it, or you're not holding on to it. It's just you expect it will happen because you kind of trust each other and have a...
Well, there's a specific institution that operated in the ancient world that mediated that, which was the institution of guest friendship, or xenia in Greek, which is the idea that you form a relationship with other clans or families or individuals that can go down through time, but it's bound by rules of conduct. It's like hospitality, basically. Mm. So if Grandad sort of Demetrius met up with Grandad Pericles, even their descendants can say, we have guest friendship because our grandfathers met up, and that means that they owe each other certain obligations. And this goes back to the idea of genealogy as blockchain, that it's a distributed ledger of value, of credit and debit, basically. Mm. So it's kind of working. It's a ledger of credit and debit, but it's not working through the mediation of tokens. It's working through the mediation of memory.
Mm-hmm. And honor, I guess.
And honor, yeah, exactly. And genealogies, basically, genealogical records in the human memory. And, of course, if everybody's bought into that norm, that value within your sort of cultural context, then it works. And in the ancient Mediterranean, it seems that there were times when, you know, whole regions are bought into this notion of xenia. And so you can have kind of networks of exchange that are based on that rather than, you know, what we would think of as more traditional sort of tokenistic exchange or trade.
So that's a really great point. And it shows just how much of a difference there is between us and the ancient people. Because, you know, for us, there are these two very clear polarities. There is exchange for profit on one hand, where I give something, I get something back, and it's very clear which party gets what. And at the polar opposite, there is a gift, which is charity, I just give something and I get nothing back in return. But the separation of these two into these pure forms isn't the only way in which it existed. And actually, in the ancient world, it seems a lot of the transactions were somewhere in a middle zone. Mm. I give something, I don't get anything in return right now, but there is an expectation that in general I will be getting a benefit. So the gift wasn't really a gift, but it wasn't also trade in a sense of very specific trade of X for Y.
And the way that, sorry, the way that this is articulated as well, which I want to get in here because this is my yep. oar that I'm always sticking in, is that this is mediated through the language of gods and the divine, right? So the guarantor of hospitality of Xenia is Zeus. Like that is how it is done. And that's how you solve for having the kind of, that's how you bootstrap the authority. It was like, well, on whose authority are we doing this? Who's guaranteeing this? Who's standing behind this yep. form of exchange? And it's a god that stands behind the form of exchange. And so you can kind of see in this model, and I hope this isn't too much of a stretch, but Zeus is the sort of the central bank or the issuing authority. He's the source of the fiat for that mechanism.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that also gives grounds, because ultimately that's on the idea level, right? But yeah. on an empirical level, there will be social sanction for breaches of rules,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And it will be, the sanction will also be based on the fact that you have offended the god, right? You yeah. have offended the god, and now we can't deal with you because until you
yeah.
make restitution.
Yeah, exactly.
We pulled you off course a bit.
Sorry.
From that.
No, but this is an absolutely critical point, I think, because a lot of things we take for granted evolved over time as ever more kind of specific separations and specializations of what used to be deeply intertangled.
Yeah, integrated, yeah.
And integrated, yeah. So if we go back to our state of nation, we try to think about, the solution. So we've understood, okay, in general, it seems when there is surplus production in this kind of archipelago context, it'd be nice if the people who work can just deliver fish to others in return for an expectation that they will receive fish themselves. Mm. And we can't, we didn't really go, of course, because at this point we see that we can't really say, does it have to be a gift? Does it have to be an exchange? Does it have to be clear whether it's one or the other?
Yeah, it is the same kind of system we've been talking about. Yeah, it's like here's some fish, and then,
The same need can be served by a wide variety of kind of specific social institutions. A god can feature in that institution. It cannot feature. That's just kind of a matter of historical accident, as you could say, or a particular culture that supports this or that rationalization of what's going on.
I'm just going to register an objection there. I think a god would stand behind it in all circumstances.
Always.
Personally,
whether we
articulate it as a god specifically in that specific cultural language or not, the same thing is happening is my view, but
as in you're saying the Bank of England is kind of
a god.
I think that something sacred, you mean, right?
It's something you put your faith in, which doesn't have necessarily an empirical foundation for that faith. It only works because everybody else does as well.
So let's think a little bit more about how it could work in practice, right? So we need a mechanism by which the producers of fish today can get access to fish tomorrow. And maybe the most immediate kind of purely commercial way, some kind of credit, right? I record the specific name of the specific person who received the delivery of fish from me today. And let's say, I delivered 10 kilograms of fish to Bob. Bob now owes me 10. Tomorrow I can come to him and say, hey, where can I get my 10 from you? So let's start developing the story a little bit. Let's say I fish today. I deliver it to Bob. Bob gives me an obligation. I owe you 10. Let's say tomorrow you actually feel like fishing again, right? Because, you don't know when you want to take the rest. Mm. The day is nice, maybe. I don't know. Mm. Maybe you want to go outside. So you go and fish again. So today you don't need Bob's obligation. Tomorrow, let's say you don't fish. Okay, so you need to go out and buy, you need to try and procure fish. Now you have a choice. You go to the person who fished today. You can issue your own obligation and you say, I will owe you 10, let's say. But you have Bob's obligation already. You don't need to write an obligation in your name. Bob owes you 10, so you can say, hey, look, Bob owes me 10. Why don't I transfer Bob's obligation to you? And here, kind of an incredible thing happens. It's almost like a bit of magic. Marx called it kind of the alchemy of money. Because the first time the credit got issued, Bob's 10, obligation for 10 got issued. When I need to buy something, I can now use that one. Let's say I give it to you. Mm. Means you, the next day, when you need to buy something, you can use the same obligation. the person who receives it can use the same obligation. And it never really needs to be cashed in.
Mm.
That's it. Once it has been created,
mm.
it can just be passed around. At some point, maybe somebody will actually come to Bob and say, hey, can I please have some fish? And that obligation will be canceled. But it doesn't have to be. It can just continue circulating forever. We can also think about, well, when would you use the Bob's obligation as a means of payment instead of your own? Maybe if Bob is very well known, mm. right? If Bob is an important person in our archipelago and he is known to fish often, that you can always come to him and get fish from him, then...
He's a particularly productive fisherman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it could be that, you know, I'm looking to buy some fish. I have the choice of issuing my own obligation or the Bob's. And let's say I want to get 10K of fish from you. And we talk and you say, yeah, okay, look, I can give you 10K of fish, but if you are going to owe me, you're going to owe me 12. But if you're going to give me Bob's 10, I will take Bob's 10.
Mm. Mm. I trust Bob more than you. Yeah. He's a better fisherman. Yeah.
Your debt will be discounted.
Mm.
And now a really magical thing happens. Because once we introduce discounting, we seemed to have trading in kilograms, right? But the kilograms are no longer kilograms.
Mm.
If I will only give you 10 for an obligation of your 12 because I don't trust you, now the kilogram has kind of become a notional unit,
mm.
which it's not clear even how many kilograms it refers to, because let's even go it a little bit further. So let's say I delivered fish to Bob. He gave me an obligation for 10. The next day, I need to buy some fish. But there isn't any fish. Let's say for some reason there was a hurricane. Few fishermen went out to sea. The fishing just wasn't very good. You know, fish production is not stable. So and the volatility was negative this time. So there's very little fish. There are lots of people with existing obligations. You know, I have an IOU from Bob. You have an IOU from Mary. You have an IOU from Adam. We all go to the market. The fishermen come in. There is little fish. Somebody will eventually say, hey, I really want your 10K. I'm willing to give you 12. You will say, I'm willing to give you 13. I'm willing to give you 14. We'll bid up with kilograms, the present kilograms. We'll be paying 15 for 10.
Yeah. So one of your fish now is worth one and a half of my fish later.
So that's one of the ways where we start. Well, we started with a completely natural unit, which seemed to refer to something physical. But because of the volatilities and the natures of exchange, it is now becoming an abstract notional unit, which is still denominated in kilograms, but doesn't actually mean kilograms.
To play devil's advocate then, so I definitely see what you mean here. But why can't we, does it have to be, is it actually a completely abstracted unit, or is it just future fish?
That's absolutely the critical question. That's what we need to think about. And it's kind of both. It is future fish, but you don't know how much.
No, because the future, there's an inherent uncertainty in the future.
Yeah.
And one of the elements that goes into the degree of uncertainty is the trust you have in the issuer of the debt in the present. So I see that it's a more elaborated or a more complex unit, because it has more elements than the tangible commodity in the present. But I don't see it as a fully abstracted unit. I don't see it as free-floating yet at this point in the story, because it still relates to something that's tangible in the future.
And I think that's the essence of money. It would never work if it was completely abstracted.
Yeah.
Money wouldn't work if you couldn't pay with it. But it is detached from specificity. So it's abstracted in a very technical sense of abstraction, not made up, but precisely abstracted, not specific, generalized.
Yeah.
Even with one good, that's the most amazing thing, right? Because we are used to be talking about the medium of exchange, the universal medium when we have a variety of goods.
Mm.
But even with one good, you see how the abstraction happens, because now the one monetary kilogram doesn't mean 1 kilogram. It means whatever the market conditions will be prevailing whenever you will try to cash that in.
You could
get 1.2, you could get 0.8, you don't know. But notionally, you have a kilogram.
Mm.
And this is actually completely common in monetary systems. So even, and this confuses the hell out of people.
So can I just pause there? So what is the key point? I think this is what Marx was getting at with his alchemy point, is that the concept of the fish and the concept of the monetary representation of the fish do not actually supervene at this point.
Exactly.
They are not identical.
Exactly.
There is something else in the monetary unit. And so it is like you have transformed one substance into another.
Precisely.
And that's the alchemy.
And not only have you transformed it, notionally, it is asserted to be identical. You still assert the kilogram to be a kilogram,
yes,
whilst knowing that it will never be exactly a kilogram.
Yes, that is the magic.
You have created something abstract, which pretends to be something physical and only works because of that pretension, but at the same time isn't what it pretends to be.
Sorry, I interrupted again.
I mean, this is absolutely one of the critical points. What was I going to say?
We were talking about the specific market conditions that determine the value of the monetary unit at that time.
The fact that it's with one good,
we can see this emerging with only one commodity in an economy that's built on one economy. So presumably you were going to talk about what happens when there are multiple commodities at play.
Well, we don't need to get into that because that kind of complicates the picture. Basically, it just shows that the reality is that both the Bazar story has something to it,
yeah,
because we do deal with a world of multiple commodities, but we would have money even if we just had one commodity. And in some sense, the one commodity picture more clearly shows the magic, as it were, and how the abstraction can happen even in very physically limited circumstances. I think...
So you've got your fish, but also time and risk.
Another thing to talk about is, we're still at kilograms still. There are two things. What I was going to talk about is how this detachment, whilst retaining the physical notion, happens historically and how it confuses the hell out of people. This happens when we have transitioned to a precious metal economy, and people will read records of banks, like European banks in the Middle Ages, for example, and they will see pounds of silver there. And historically, people assumed that they mean pounds of silver. We now know that they don't, and it's now commonly referred to in the literature as a bank pound. So people were very clear. So you would be recorded as owing a pound of silver, but it would be the bank pound, because then there would be the prevailing price of silver in the market on any particular day, which doesn't have to be 1 pound. So what is asserted to be a standard in a ledger isn't actually a physical standard, because you would also have a price for the physical silver in the market at that day. So for a long time, people thought that the system is much more physical than it really is, because the pretense is that it's physical and the units are physical. They're literally weight of silver. But in reality, the silver that is meant is this bank silver. As you have said, we have created this new unit, which only exists within the monetary system as a kind of abstraction. It's linked to the physical silver, but it is separate from it and has a varying price from day to day.
Can you see it as a sort of coordination point? Can you see this as a coordination problem, right? That all of the relative value of everything is constantly shifting because it's in time.
Yeah.
Right. But in order to cooperate, you need to coordinate around a particular value of exchange. And so you have to have something that's abstracted that can be stable in order to coordinate your economic activities. Is that something like what's going on
that
here?
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
You've hit absolutely the nail on the head on a second critical point, is that this kind of abstraction, precisely by being an abstraction, fulfills a universal rational demand of having a point of reference that can serve precisely as a stable one, right? The problem with actual kilograms of fish on any particular day is that you don't know what that kilogram is going to be worth. You know that you're going to have to go out and fish, you're going to have to put in effort, but you don't know what you will get back from that effort. But you want to value your effort kind of as such. And if you have an abstracted unit, you can now value your effort in that abstracted unit, which is stable across the volatility of actual efficiency of production. And again, that happens even with one commodity. It even becomes more pronounced in one commodity, but it also features as a need with multiple commodities. And that's why no commodity can really serve as that standard, because, you know, we choose gold, tomorrow a gold mine just collapses because construction wasn't all that good. Suddenly, everybody's labor is worth more, but only because a mine collapsed, right? That makes no sense. We want a different unit, precisely one that would be stable to any kind of volatility in a specific commodity.
Yeah. And I think this is where you can start to go a little bit out there and say, well, you know, what are the this isn't just a problem that exists for the valuing of labor and commodities. This is the issue of a coordination problem exists in almost every single realm of human life and activity if you are dealing with other humans, right? And I think that, again, this you can see this is one of the functions of gods, that they are stable coordination points, that they only work as stable coordination points because everybody is agreed that that is the stable coordination point. And I think that in the way that we are able to convince other human beings to cooperate with us around stable coordination points is by using the language of the sacred, because these coordination points are absolutely fundamental to society or cooperation or organization working. And as such, but also they're intangible, you can't see them, but they are also real, they lie behind everything that happens. And they are unbelievably powerful. And if they break or you don't honor them or approach them in the right way, everything falls apart. And so I think that when you look at the function and the nature of this coordination point, it really does start to look like a god, I would personally argue. So I want to, again, just kind of raise the question of, you know, really, is it any coincidence that, you know, the first thing to be put on coins are pictures of gods? And, you know, is it really a coincidence that we think of, you know, Mammon, the god of money, and, you know, all that kind of thing, that we use the language of the divine? Is it really a coincidence that there's, you know, the absolutely classic kind of idea of a precious or valuable metal as gold, and gold looks like sunlight, and the sun is always a god, and, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I know that there's, you know, I quickly go beyond what I can sort of empirically support there, or I quickly go beyond what are falsifiable statements, but I don't know, I just want to kind of push that envelope and just put it in there for what it's worth. What do you think of that?
I think there's a great point. There's also like a bugbear, like every single historian of monetary matters will pick up on that, so I have to as well. Gold was never the prototypical monetary metal. Silver is the standard precious metal, like the Maria Theresa Thaler we talked about was a silver coin.
That was quite recent.
It was quite recent, but throughout history, silver being much more abundant and more reasonable in terms of its value compared to the day-to-day needs of transactions.
But it's rather like Kruger and now, worth like 25 grand each, which isn't a useful amount for a coin. Yeah.
Exactly. Gold was so expensive as to never really be practical as a medium of exchange. It was used occasionally, but its real dominance only came in the 19th century. It was a state creation when these very advanced national states introduced the gold standard. Even then, it was firstly a bimetallic standard, and then eventually they moved to gold at all. And it only could happen, actually, because by then so much circulation was based on fiat. So gold could just lie in your Fort Knox,
he knows that.
And you trade the certificates for it. Gold is a very unusual metal as a monetary.
I stand chastened and corrected. But I don't think that's actually a critical foundation.
No, it's
the
not.
Point
it's
I was
not.
Making.
It's
the
not,
poetic
it,
foundation.
Yeah,
poetic, that's
the ecstatic truth.
That's why I called it a bugbear. It's just that. But I think the important point, so you make a psychological point, I think, or you focus on the psychology of what can convince people to really believe it. I would highlight the philosophical side of it, which is the need that is being addressed by this abstract unit of valuation of anything which is stable to variations in any specifics is a universal human need. Well, more than human, it's a universal need of any rational agent at all. So money is really a feature of rationality, of rationalizing our attitude to the world, by introducing these stable points around which we can make calculation, right? Mm. So it's an essential mechanism of decision making, precisely by the features that you have outlined. Now, there's a different question of, you know, just because there is a need doesn't mean it will be automatically fulfilled. And there's a very interesting interplay. As you know, we can say, okay, any rational agent needs this point of reference, but we're not just rational agents. We're very much kind of emotionally driven creatures. And we need these kinds of stories of the sacred for us to be able to make use of this point of reference, because it's rational nature doesn't have much pull by itself, right? It needs the psychology around
it. It needs a story.
It needs a story, yeah.
Yeah.
You also want everyone to understand what it is, and not everyone is going to understand the full.
Yeah. Nobody will understand why money exists, really. So you need a false explanation that will be good enough for them to believe it.
Yeah. But I mean, yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you sit down with, you know, somebody down the docks and say, well, what we need is a stable point of coordination.
Yeah, or you start going on, like, imagine there is an archipelago of fishermen.
Yeah.
But you could also say this applies to a lot of cultural practices that come to us via religion. It's, you know, they're actually quite healthy ways of running a society, but you can't build up the argument from rationality. Instead, you just say, well, God told us to live in this way.
And that was the greatest point of stupidity of the Enlightenment thinkers, which only saw kind of prejudice and obscurity in religious thinking because they didn't understand that these manifestations of perfectly rational things can take on symbolic and religious forms. And the story doesn't have to be literally true for its content to be rational, useful, and needed. Mm. Yeah.
But I would argue that there we're putting the cart before the horse in the same way as we were with money and cigarettes, in the sense that it's not that these rational things are taking on religious or sacred forms. I would argue you start with the religious or the sacred form, and then there's a post factum rational retelling of the story. Now, I'm not being totally relativist here. I'm not saying that there's no difference between a sort of mythological story or justification and the rational one. I think that there is a difference in kind between those two stories, but arguably they are both stories.
Yeah. I mean, that's also a great point. We get into kind of a very classic trope of Hegelian thought here. And I agree with you that the kind of concrete symbolical stories are historically primary. They are what exists first. And we only come to understand their purported rational content once we look back and reflect upon them. Now, then there's a question of, well, do we believe that the rational content is really rational in any real sense, or is it just a yet another set of stories? No, I happen to believe that, you know, we can figure out genuine rationality.
Okay.
So in some ways, and that was kind of Hegel's idea, that the truth is already given to us in this mythological form. It's already there, but it's not the full truth because we don't understand it as such. We only understand it symbolically through this kind of naive, we could call it, story.
Yeah.
And then eventually we come to understand, as it were, the true content in itself for what it is and the role that it plays. But of course, that's much more controversial, right? And you could say that our purported rational understanding is just another retelling, which isn't any more or less valid. But I like to think optimistically that we do actually, there are genuine things that work and they stick because they work. And when we come to understand them much later, we do actually prize out the reason for why they worked and why they addressed a real need. Because I think mythologies come in all sorts of forms, right? We mythologize things which are useful, which are not useful, and eventually some die out and some stick. It's a kind of a naive evolutionary optimism I'm outlining here.
I would agree. I think that maybe this is maybe you'll think of this as a fairly naive way of looking at it, but I think that, you know, you can tell whether you're getting closer to something that is true, in inverted commas, by the power it gives you. And so, you know, is empirical knowledge more true than non-empirical knowledge? Well, by this standard, yes, because it allows you to do more things. You can build computers and go to the moon and all of that kind of thing. And well, does the rational explanation of what money is it more true than the symbolic explanation? Well, yes, because it means that you can build a more sophisticated economy once you have that understanding. That would be the way that I saw
it. Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Hope, yeah. that is presumed on politicians acting rationally and upon these understandings, which I don't think we can really hope for. But
sorry, I cut you off.
Well, I was going to make a more general point. We've talked about Fraser's Golden Bough before, where he says that these underlying rituals that we live our lives by stay the same, but the explanations for them change over time, whether it's a different god now or a different stage of life we're celebrating or something like that. So we're doing this, we've done the same rituals for millennia with different stories on top of them, and then you could see that rationalism is just the latest story we're putting on top of the same thing.
But you can argue that in a sort of Whiggish way that we're needing to create more sophisticated stories as the sophistication of our organization increases. And so it depends on whether you see sophistication as a sort of cipher for deep depth or truth, which I don't think it's unreasonable to do that at all. Because it ultimately is grounded in the power to manipulate the world to our own advantage. So it is actually grounded in something real, which is capability within the world that we find ourselves in.
It's ultimately a question of, what is there such a thing as knowledge, or is it all like kind of postmodern competitiveness of narratives?
And I think you can say that there is knowledge, and it's grounded in what we can actually do. It's grounded in utility. That's its ground. Yeah.
A couple more things we can touch upon. So this state of nature story of the fisherman, we can develop it a bit more. We can talk about how can there arise an agent which actually specializes on just issuance of credit. He doesn't even fish. All he does is take in obligations and issue obligations, and that's kind of what banks do. They just manage liquidity. You borrow short, lend long. That's maybe not so useful to get into the depth of that. A couple of other points. There's an interesting conception of money, which I think would be very close to what the historian is saying about the symbolic value. This is money arising as blood money. Have you come across that? One of the kind of historical ways, where do we see money come up? Well, a very typical context is a kind of sacred object, but not really in a strictly speaking a religious context, but the object in which you must pay your dues when you have wronged someone. That's really, especially in Germanic contexts, one of the standard legal codes is literally just a price list for crimes, right? And the price list is often denominated in specific types of things, right? It's not that you can deliver anything, but you are often prescribed to deliver a very specific thing. So sometimes it can be goods of a particular kind, like, for this infraction, you must deliver camels. For another infraction, you must deliver grain. But often where we see money arise is actually in this specific kind of token, which is used precisely for making restitution. Blood money, Wehrgeld.
It's the same in the Mycenaeans as well. In the Iliad, I think it's Achilles, it's quite explicit that you can murder someone, but as long as you pay the blood price, it's all good.
And that's an interesting question about an abstract standard as well, because sometimes we need to commensurate the wrongs. If you wounded me with a knife, but I stole a jug, who owes who? Right? And the wrongs are particularly interesting because the wrongs themselves are incredibly specific, right? Where any kind of pain inflicted, any kind of damage inflicted, any kind of property damage or theft is very related to the specific object upon which it happened, and yet they need to be commensurated. They need to be balanced against each other. We as a society need some way of saying, you harmed each other in two very different ways. Who is actually the party that is left more damaged? And we need an assessment for this damage. And again, we don't really even necessarily need a token there, but we do need, in our mind, a measure. And the measure has to come in units. Yeah. You need to say
how many fish.
So often you would fix upon a token, but the really the rational kind of need behind it is that harm needs to be measured. So you need a unit of harm, and often money comes around precisely as a token, which becomes that unit of harm that can commensurate wrongs.
Life is damage.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite similar to the current thing where to make policy decisions, you have to put a pound value on a human life.
Yeah,
in order to make rational decisions.
Apparently, in the US, I read this that this is obviously very this is very apposite to insurance.
Yep. Right? Yep.
And apparently, if you really, really dig in and do the maths, the value of a human life in the United States is something around $10 million. Seems quite high to me. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it will highly depend on the context of valuation.
Yeah.
Whose life valued for what purpose?
I mean,
obviously,
what I mean by that comment is that I'm surprised that that an insurance system values it so highly. Not that I think that a human life is worth less. Obviously, it's priceless.
A similar calculation, they tell you the story often in economics undergraduate classes as when seatbelts were first developed. And, there's a cost to putting a seatbelt in a car. So how did manufacturers make the decision? Is it worth putting the seatbelt in a car? And the original calculation for a profit-driven manufacturer was precisely, how much will we be liable for if we don't versus, how can we reduce our liability by putting in the seatbelt? But that actually shows how much these measures are artificially constructed because they are driven by the... Or in this case, by the liability that the state would put upon you. There's no reason why a manufacturer needs to be held liable at all, right? Somebody killed themselves by driving badly, it's their own fault.
So perhaps a final thought then for us to end on, and this doesn't need a conclusive answer, but it's certainly the one I'm interested in. Maybe you have a final question as well. But people talk in the modern era about the market as a sort of an agent in itself, as something that has needs or wishes or motivations and acts within the world. In the context of what we've been discussing, what is your sort of gut reaction to that? Do you think that is a fallacy or do you think that has some justification?
So I think this tallies very nicely with what we've been discussing. I think this kind of personification is a symbolic, quasi-religious way of talking about something which is on the surface obviously false. Market is not a person, but at the same time, it is a symbolic expression of a real phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
The market is a structure which drives people to behave in a particular way. So it is, in some sense, an agentive structure, is that it acts upon the world. It does have a direction which it prescribes, and the easiest way to talk about this is to personify the market.
Exactly.
So that just goes back to how our psychology works, and we shouldn't be easily triggered by people making this personification. We should try to understand, what is it, what they're really getting at? Okay, sure, on the surface they're speaking nonsense, but what's their real meaning?
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you very much.
A deep dive, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I hope we can do it again. There we go. Let's hope it was recording.
Yeah, I mean, 100% chance of something.